I need a job with a steady paycheck.
I need a job that offers health care on day one for me and my kids.
I want a job where I can get certified in technical roles, like robotics or software engineering.
In communities across the country, hourly Amazon employees earn an average of over $23 an hour, with opportunities to grow their skills and their paycheck by enrolling in free skills training programs and apprenticeships. Learn more at aboutamazon.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Welcome to the Rusk Report on ESPN AM 1520. And we're very fortunate today to have the keynote speaker for the General Pulaski Association Installation Dinner, Andrew Nagorski. And you probably have seen his books in different bookstores all over the country, The Nazi Hunters by Simon & Schuster. Tell you a little bit about Andrew Nagorski. He is an award-winning journalist and author who spent more than three decades as a foreign correspondent and editor for Newsweek. From 2008 to 2014, he was vice president and director of public policy for the East-West Institute, an international affairs think tank. Andrew Nagorski is now based in St. Augustine, Florida, but continues to travel extensively, writing for numerous publications. Both of his most recent books, Hitlerland, American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power, Simon Schuster, 2012, and Nazi Hunters, Simon Schuster, 2016. They've received rave reviews. Our guest today, Andrew Nagorski, and we thank you for coming to Western New York, to Buffalo, to be our keynote speaker. So let's first talk about the evils of World War II. As the author of The Nazi Hunters, how would you describe this, Andrew Nagorski?
Well, first of all, Brian, thanks for having me on, and I'm looking forward, of course, to the Pulaski Society dinner. To describe the evils of World War II, it is on such a scale. I mean, every war has its horror stories. Every war has some massacres, but what happened under the Third Reich, under Hitler, was that it was industrialized killing of men, women, and children on a scale we'd never seen before. And therefore, one of the questions as the war was ending was, how do you begin to get any sort of justice when there are so many people involved in millions of murders? And of course, and most prominently of the Holocaust, where the Jewish people were targeted for extermination, other peoples were targeted for assassination, slave labor, and so forth, but the Jewish people were targeted for complete annihilation. So the big powers, Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill, began discussing this question as early as 1943, 2 years before the war ended, and they came up with this notion of holding trials of at least some of the top leaders, and trying to say that we've got to not just have revenge, but we have to have an accounting and also put on the record what happened so that we can try to learn something from it. And that was the origin of the Nuremberg trials, and that was the origin of the trials that have continued right up till today. Even last year, there were two trials of former Auschwitz guards in Germany. So this has been an ongoing process, and each of these trials reveals those horrors. What really happened in those concentration camps, what happened before the concentration camps really became mass killing grounds, and there were special units of German soldiers that just went in and lined up Jewish, Gypsy, and an assortment of so-called other enemies, and would mow everyone down. So the horrors are, no matter how much you've read, and I've interviewed a lot of survivors, of camps, of various massacres, no matter how much you've read, how much you've heard, how much you've seen, you're never quite ready to absorb the full dimension of the horrors of World War II.
In the Nazi Hunters, you talk about the courts in Germany fighting to hold accountable Reinhold Hanning, a 94-year-old former Auschwitz guard who's charged as an accessory to the murder of at least 117,000 people. Let's talk about people like that. How many people escaped justice who committed mass murders?
Well, first of all, you have to say more people escaped justice than ever faced justice. Now, as the war was ending, there was some indiscriminate killing, particularly by the Red Army, by the Soviet Army, and there were mass rapes and so forth, which is the way in previous wars it would happen, that the victors would simply kill, pillage, rape, but there would be no sort of systematic justice, and many innocent people were victims to that. And that happened as Germany was losing the war too, but then there was this attempt to do more systematic justice, and they tried to round up some of the most senior figures. Of course, Hitler had committed suicide, and some other, and there were a few other suicides. But most people had either, there were some prominent Nazis who escaped to Latin America in particular, and one or two to the Middle East. Adolf Eichmann was a very famous architect of the Holocaust who escaped to Buenos Aires. But most people actually were hiding in plain sight. They went back, the people who had been in the Gestapo and other security services, who were parts of these killing squads, they simply went back and resumed their lives. So the idea was to at least get some of those people on trial. And right at the end of the war, as I mentioned, there was a Nuremberg trial, which was some of the top leaders, and then there was a series of subsequent Nuremberg trials and Dachau trials, which took place, the U.S. Army carried out, and there were trials also in Eastern Europe. But even that only scratched the surface, and what happened was very quickly the Cold War set in, and both sides got, both the Western Allies and the Soviet Union were much more interested, for instance, in grabbing German scientists who they could use for their rocket programs than in prosecuting war criminals. And they were, and in the case of the U.S., they wanted to get West German populace and government in behind them in the Cold War. And so there was a real, after the initial 3 or 4 years of really trying to get some justice, many of the people who had not been executed yet, because there were quite a few senior officials were executed towards the end of the war, but those who had not been executed immediately, eventually many of them were, or their sentences were commuted, and they got out. So there was very little going on in the 50s, say, and then when Israel managed to kidnap Adolf Eichmann in Buenos Aires, bring him back to Israel, hold a trial where people could see really what the whole Holocaust was about, how it functioned, that spurred other people like the people I call the Nazi hunters in my book, some of whom were officials, but some of whom were private individuals, Holocaust survivors of the camps, people like Simon Wiesenthal, who I knew very well when he was alive.
He was a guest on this program.
Was he? Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And, an amazing man. They began to put pressure on governments. You've got to bring more people to justice. And they would publicize these cases. They'd provide them leads. And eventually in Germany, there was a whole debate about this, because in Germany at first, when after the responsibility for bringing these people to court was left to the Germans as opposed to the Allied victors, these cases were treated like normal murder trials. You had to kind of prove one what the individual was responsible for, what particular deaths or torture or other crimes. Now, that was hard to do when most of your victims had not survived, obviously, and even those who had survived often did their utmost to not to look in the eyes of the people who held their life in the balance. And what happened was that eventually there was a court case involving an automaker, for a retired auto worker from Cleveland, Ivan Demyanuk, who had been a concentration camp guard. And it was a long, convoluted legal saga, and there was some misidentification at first. But eventually, they convicted this man on the basis that as a concentration camp guard, he had willingly participated in basically Murder, Inc., this system of murder. And that he could be, you didn't have to prove specific deaths, specific crimes, because he was part of the killing machine. And on that basis, when that ruling came down, that opened the way for other trials of people like Reinhold Hunting, who had been in their early 20s. They were junior guards, but they were also part of that killing machine. And these people who are being tried today or recently may never see the inside of a jail, because even if when they are found guilty, as Hunting has been, they have appeals and so forth, and they may not live to ever serve out their sentence. But I think it is important that legal judgment and moral judgment is passed, because these were folks who, you know, they always said, we were following orders. Everybody, you know, just said we had no choice. Well, in fact, you signed up to be part of the SS, our concentration camp guard. Mm-hmm. You were recruited, but you could refuse. Or you could say, I didn't want to. That probably meant you would be sent to the front, and there would be people shooting at you instead of you killing everyone with defenseless civilians. But that was a moral choice. And so that's why these last cases are significant. And as I say, each of these cases is important as a means to educate the next generation about what really happened during the war, during the Holocaust.
For those who just tuned in, we're learning a great deal from famous author Andrew Nagorski. Again, the book is The Nazi Hunters. It's published by Simon & Schuster, so it's available throughout the United States and Canada. We highly recommend this to you. Again, Andrew Nagorski is in Buffalo, New York, to be the keynote speaker for the General Pulaski Association Installation Banquet. A little bit about the newspaper that interviewed Andrew Nagorski earlier today. Western New Yorkers love their traditions, and the Ampol Eagle has been writing about Polish-American traditions and events for over 50 years. News and features from a Polish-American perspective can be found in this weekly newspaper, as well as recipes and a calendar of events. Don't miss out on the next cultural presentation or polka dance by reading the Ampol Eagle. The Ampol Eagle is available in many Tops and Wegmans stores. For home delivery, call 716-835-9454. That's 716-835-9454 to have the latest news from Poland and Polonia in your mailbox each week. And I'm sure that publisher Roger Puchalski will have a very interesting interview. He interviewed Andrew Nagorski for 45 minutes before this taping. A little bit more information about Andrew Nagorski. From 2000 to 2008, Andrew Nagorski served as senior editor for Newsweek International, handling the editorial cooperation between the parent magazine and its expanding network of foreign language editions and other joint venture partners. The new magazines that were launched during his tenure were Newsweek Arabic in 2000, Newsweek Polska, which has become Poland's leading news magazine since it was launched in 2001, Newsweek Russia in 2004, and Newsweek Argentina in 2006. Andrew Nagorski also continued to write reviews and commentaries for Newsweek International. He has been honored three times by the Overseas Press Club for his reporting. The author of The Nazi Hunters Andrew Nagorski. Now, in The Nazi Hunters, you write about a small band of men and women who refused to allow the crimes of the Third Reich to be forgotten and who are determined to track down Nazi war criminals. Let's focus on these small bands of men and women who wanted to track down these murderers.
Yeah, well, there were, you know, it's always struck me how individuals can have an impact on society. And even at the time when governments were trying to convict Nazi war criminals, the role of individual prosecutors was very important. So early on in the book, I write about some of the prosecutors who really took the initiative to get this going. And one of them, by the way, is Benjamin Ferenc, who just celebrated his, I think is just celebrating his 97th birthday. He lives in Florida, a real dynamic man who was the last surviving prosecutor at Nuremberg. And his story is when I went to interview him a few years ago for the first time when I was starting the research on the book, he told me how the U.S. had planned these follow-up trials, and he was sent as a very junior member of the prosecution team to help gather evidence for the trials. At one point, one of his co-workers brought him a stack of documents, which were these reports from the Eastern Front of these special killing squads that were going into Ukrainian, Russian, Belarusian villages and just lining up Jews and gypsies and others and shooting them. And every day they were sending back reports to Berlin with the exact number of people they'd shot in each village or town. And he said... He went back to Telfer Taylor, who was the chief U.S. prosecutor, and said, look, we've got chapter and verse on these guys. We know who led these units. We've got to try at least some of them. And Taylor at first did not want to. He said, well, we've already got planned only these 12 trials. We can't do any more, and we don't even have the budget, and I don't even have a prosecutor free to handle the case. And he said, and this was, here he was, a 27-year-old guy, straight out of Harvard Law School, and said, I'll prosecute the case. He'd never prosecuted a trial in his life, and he took on the case, and he prosecuted it, won guilty verdicts in all of these cases. So part of it, so I'm talking about people like that, and people like an investigating judge in Poland who insisted not just in prosecuting people like the commandant of Auschwitz, but in getting their testimony in great detail so that we would understand how Auschwitz worked, what the history was of it, so that people would learn from this. And then there were the private freelance investigators, most famously, as I mentioned, Simon Wiesenthal, who you've had on this program, yes. But also people like Beata and Serge Klarsfeld. And interesting enough, some of these people were Jewish, some were not Jewish. Beata Klarsfeld was from a German Christian family in Berlin. She was born in 1939. She grew up after the war. Her father had been in the German army. She, like many Germans right after the war, they never talked about really what the war was all about, only that we had suffered, not what the German army had inflicted on others. And then at age 20, she goes to Paris as an au pair, takes a job, and then meets a young Frenchman by the name of Serge Klarsfeld, who happens to be from a French-Romanian Jewish family and whose father died at Auschwitz. They fall in love, they get married, and she suddenly learns about the Holocaust, about what really happened in those war years. And she becomes this avid proponent of in her own country, of getting more justice. And to give you one example of what she did, at one point in 1968, when West Germany had a chancellor by the name of Kiesinger, who had actually served in the Third Reich and had a position there and helped justify the racist policies, she was so outraged she tried to organize protests, but nobody seemed to pay it any attention. So she got a pass to the National Convention of the Christian Democratic Union, his party, and it'd be like going to a convention of the Republicans or Democrats today, National Convention, and she snuck on stage and then slapped the chancellor in front of everybody and shouted, Nazi, Nazi. You can imagine, this is 1968.
Wow.
In that year, you know, already Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King had been assassinated in this country, and she could have been killed.
Absolutely.
But the security guards throw themselves on her. She's arrested briefly. Then they release her because they realize it's worse publicity if they keep her. And that sparked a whole debate in Germany, which began this whole process of Germany beginning to confront its past and that younger generation saying to its parents and grandparents, you have to tell us what happened during the Third Reich and what you did personally. And as a result, I think West German society, not East German society, but West German society at that time began to at least honestly deal with its past, began to teach the horrors of the Holocaust, the horrors of the Third Reich in its school curriculum, and this effort, and there it began to be a few more trials to bring that point home, and eventually that spread to France, where the French began to deal with their very mixed legacy, and eventually it even came to this country, where people began pointing to the fact that along with the legitimate refugees and displaced persons who came in after the war into this country, there were people who also had been part of, who had been in German-occupied territory and who had participated in mass atrocities. And the Justice Department set up an Office of Special Investigations, which eventually forced the stripping of the citizenship of more than 100 people and their expulsion from the United States.
We're learning a great deal from noted author, internationally acclaimed Andrew Nagorski, the author of The Nazi Hunters, published by Simon & Schuster. He is in Buffalo, New York, to be the keynote speaker at the General Pulaski Association Installation Banquet. If you're listening in Cheektowaga, Toronto, or Washington, D.C., to our 50,000 watts of clear channel power, drop us a note. We'd like to hear from our Canadian and European listeners also. Please write to Brian Rusk, ESPN Radio, 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Buffalo, New York, 14226. I'd like to thank those who've called regarding our recent guest, Mike Bellani with the Friendship Foundation, Erie County Republican Chairman Nick Langworthy, and John Manzella with World Trade. Coming up, we'll have in this program a program regarding the new Jewish Museum in Warsaw, Poland, Maria Krause with the Muscular Dystrophy Association, and State Senator Pat Galvin. A little bit more information about Andrew Nagorski. In 2009, Poland's foreign minister, Sikorski, presented Nagorski with the newly created Bene Merito Award for his reporting from Poland about the Solidarity Movement in the 80s. In 2011, Poland's President Komorowski awarded him the Cavalry Cross for the same reason. In 2014, Poland's former president and Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa presented the Lech Wałęsa Media Award to Nagorski for dedication to the cause of freedom and writing about Poland's history and culture. Noted author of the book Nazi Hunters, our guest today, Andrew Nagorski, on the Rusk Report. Now, in your book, you write about those who felt most at risk fleeing the continent after World War II. How many people fled the continent, and are there perhaps any of these war criminals still around?
Probably it tended to be the more senior people who felt that they had to flee. Actually, Beata Klarsfeld, the German Nazi hunter I mentioned, once said, "We didn't have to go to South America." For instance, she and her husband were looking for the SS and Gestapo officers who were responsible for the deportation of French Jews to death camps. And she said, "We didn't have to go into the jungles of South America. I just looked them up in the Cologne phone book." And but the senior people, like the Adolf Eichmanns, like Mengele, the famed the doctor of Auschwitz, who was called the Angel of Auschwitz in the most ironic terms, since he conducted horrible experiments.
Terrible.
They had to flee, and they had to disguise their identity. It's hard to know the numbers. It's probably not that huge, but there were a significant number, and some. Probably very few are still alive today, if any, because as I say, they were already older. But as late as the 90s, for instance, there was a SS captain who was responsible for a massacre just outside of Rome, who was actually cornered by an ABC crew with Sam Donaldson questioning him, got him on camera, and as a result, Italy eventually extradited him, this Captain Eric Priebke, and tried him and sentenced him, and he spent his last years under house arrest. So there are still cases as recently as that. But again, I'd like to emphasize that most of the people went back to their lives. And one short example of that,
yeah.
Seaman Wiesenthal tracked down the person who had arrested Anne Frank and her family in Amsterdam.
Tragedy.
A tragedy. He did it because there are people trying to discredit Anne Frank's diary. The former Nazis who were trying to tell young people in Austria, oh, it's not a true story. He said, I've got to prove it is a true story, and I'll find the person who had her arrested. He found him. Where did he find this person after several years of hunting? He was back on his job in the Vienna police force.
Unbelievable.
And nothing ever happened to him, but it did manage to basically put an end to all those people who are trying to deny the veracity of Anne Frank's story. And as we know, Anne Frank's story has educated successive generations about the Holocaust, because that one powerful story of one individual has often a bigger impact than to talk about millions of deaths.
Yeah, poor teenage girl suffering like that. We have a minute left on the Rusk Report. What about you and former Secretary Kurt Waldheim and his wartime past?
Well, former UN, I covered the story when Kurt Waldheim was running for president of Austria in 1986, and it became apparent that he had covered up. I mean, everyone knew he had been in the German army in the Eastern Front, but he conveniently forgot, he said, to mention in all the official biographies that he'd also been in a unit in the Balkans that was involved in war crimes. Whether that made him personally responsible or not was debatable, but he had staged a cover-up. So I was one of the reporters who was there, who also went into an area where in Yugoslavia, what was then Yugoslavia, where these massacres took place, and I interviewed survivors. And it was one of these really nasty debates about personal accountability. And the thing that really bothered me was that Kurt Waldheim very much played up an anti-Semitic theme, blaming it all on Jews from outside, allegedly stirring this up. And it created real divisions also among the Nazi hunters, because one of the stories of my book is not just sort of good guys versus bad guys. Mm-hmm. There are also, among the Nazi hunters, these were very ambitious, competing individuals, and sometimes they had conflicts over tactics. And Wiesenthal, for instance, who was based in Vienna, did not like the way the World Jewish Congress, which was based in New York, handled the case. So it's a very complicated story, but I think Kurt Waldheim, no question, had at the very least lied by omission about what he had done.
Sorry, we have to bring the Rusk Report to a close. We've learned a great deal from the speaker at the Pulaski Banquet, the author of The Nazi Hunters, Andrew Nagorski, published by Simon & Schuster. Special thanks to Kevin Carr, Director of Production, for the last 15 years. Thank you for enlightening us, author Andrew Nagorski.
My pleasure.
Have a great week.
I need a job with a steady paycheck.
I need a job that offers health care on day one for me and my kids.
I want a job where I can get certified in technical roles, like robotics or software engineering.
In communities across the country, hourly Amazon employees earn an average of over $23 an hour, with opportunities to grow their skills and their paycheck by enrolling in free skills training programs and apprenticeships. Learn more at aboutamazon.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.